The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Our next panel is on international development policy. As the previous discussion indicated, the work of foreign donors have an impact in some ways well beyond the simple numbers of the dollars or euros they invest in poor countries. Small investments can have enormous impact on the structure of service systems and how people with disabilities function in society. So this panel provides us an opportunity for looking at implementation of the convention through foreign assistance work. We'll start off with Judy Heumann. I'm not going to give extensive introductions to anyone because they're in your conference material, but Judy is really one of the founders of the disability movement in the United States since her work with the creation of the Independent Living Center in Berkeley, and has had experience as, I believe it was Assistant Secretary of Education. She's been the World Bank's Officer on Disability, and now the head of the Global Partnership on Disability and Development. And no one has been more actively involved, both in from the inside of the disability movement and now in the international development movement, than Judy.
Thank you very much. What I would like to do is reflect a little bit on what I see as the reality that we have to be addressing when moving forward in implementation through an international development policy. The comments that Eric and Lori were making with the film that was just shown, and the comments that people made to them about why these types of institutions needed to be maintained, and comments from Europeans, which could have just as easily been made by Americans or anyone from the development institutions or pick a group, I think is really central to what we have to be focusing on. When we look at the process that went on in the passage of the UN Convention, what do we see? We see that there were very unique opportunities over a relatively short period of time where disabled people from different national, regional, and international organizations and their allies came together to meet with representatives from state governments. And they weren't casual interactions. People didn't come together for a three-hour meeting or a one-day meeting. People came together for weeks at a time, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and I don't know how many weeks altogether over the four-year period of time, but we're talking about months, where people, this not always the same people, but many of the same people reappeared. And I think this is a very important issue, because when the discussions on the convention began, it wasn't just that people didn't believe it could happen. One of the reasons people believed it couldn't happen is because of the significant lack of knowledge on the part of representatives from governments that disabled people could benefit from a human rights convention like other groups, children, women, etc. I believe it's very important to recognize that the discrimination that disabled people have faced in every country in the world, including the United States, has very much put us in a place where people in positions of authority in development institutions and human rights organizations are basically fearful of those of us with disabilities and have very few models that they can really reflect on. And the failure to have positive models that they can reflect on, also the fact that those people in their training programs, undergraduate programs, graduate programs, professional programs, vocational programs, whatever it may be, also do not learn about what disabled people can do, do not look at the barriers that we face on a day-to-day basis and how it is the barriers that we face that have resulted in our inability to be integrated into society. Now, we can talk about it and reflect on it in the convention, we can talk about how we move away from the medical model to the social model. And that's all very true. But the reality of the situation is very few people in the disability community or in the non-disability community have really been touched by the efforts that have gone on in the passage of this convention. And I think we need to build on that. And I do very much believe that the ability for the disability community, a very cross-disability community, the most cross-disability community that ever was actively engaged in any international or national or state or local levels, came together. And so my presumption is that the representatives from governments and hopefully from the UN itself who participated in those discussions had to begin to have their viewpoint of what their negative images of disabled people were, and at least had to be willing to open a window in their minds, to be willing to listen to some of the very provocative comments and work that was being done by disabled people, demanding very, very strategic and significant changes that ultimately need to be made in our societies. I believe if we gloss over that, we in fact will not see the implementation of the efforts that people have made over the last 4 years. So I want to talk just for a couple of minutes about some of the activities that we can look at in the United States with some of the legislation that we have had passed over the years and what we did to both educate disabled people, because I think this is a critical component here, that disabled people in all countries need to be able to be educated where they are not on what the convention is and how, what the steps are that need to be utilized in order to implement it within their country. And from the U.S. perspective, I would like to say that most disabled people in the United States have never heard of the convention. And if they've heard of the convention, they've only heard of a U.N. convention on the rights of people with disabilities. I venture to say that 99.9% of those people, if you ask them to give you one specific objective that the convention is supposed to implement, not through any fault of their own, but they can't answer that question. So when we talk about the U.S. becoming more engaged in what, why is the convention important to us here in the United States, I think one of the outcomes that, that we need to look at from today's meeting is some very simple materials that can be written up for disabled individuals, all types of disabilities in the U.S., and parent organizations regarding what is this convention and does it mean anything to us. Is the justice in pieces piece that came out the piece that we should be abiding by? Is the convention from a U.S. perspective something that we don't have any time for because we have so many problems ourselves? I think many of the speakers previously have talked about why this convention is important to us in the United States, but we need a very simple article with some very simple questions and answers that can be put across all of the websites that people deal with. And in conferences that we're holding in the U.S., this is an issue which has to be discussed, or the U.S. will not be a major player because we don't understand the issues. I think it's different when we look at other countries. I think Europe and Scandinavia, African countries, Asian countries, and the Middle East, more of their disability rights organizations, but not all of them, are also more engaged and more knowledgeable about this convention, in part because their countries have a history of engaging in a different way with the United Nations than we do. So I think that's an important point. But nonetheless, when looking at Article 32, which I think Charlotte raised this morning on international cooperation, I think this is a very important article that we need to be looking at when looking at the issue of implementation through international development policy. We need to be looking not just from within the U.S., but we can start with the U.S., and ask, what is the United States government doing with its foreign aid? And is the foreign aid that we are giving explicitly ensuring that the issue of disability is meaningfully integrated into the grants and contracts which are being awarded, and how are we monitoring that? Now, there is work that's being done, for example, by USAID, working with Senator Leahy and Senator Harkin and others to try to get not only language, which there has previously been, but strengthening language, which would help to ensure that disabled people's organizations here in the United States that are doing work in international are not overshadowed by the larger NGOs, which in many cases are receiving millions and millions of dollars and are very integrated into the USAID and State Department and other programs, so they easily can capture money. We're looking at what needs to be done to help ensure that DPOs in the United States can, in fact, access funding. But we're also needing to make sure that DPOs in middle-income and developing countries that are benefiting from U.S. foreign assistance are also seen as integral partners, both with the U.S. DPOs and with the NGOs, such as Sam will talk about through interaction. So we're coming back to the original point. We need to allow both government and those who will be applying for money in the area of education, in the area of housing, in the area of transport, in the area of justice, legal rights, whatever it may be, to also be informed by the disabled people's organizations about how disability can be meaningfully integrated into the grants and contracts that they're applying for. So it means that those of us in this country have to be much more knowledgeable about grant making from the government and from the private sector. The private sector, I think, is slowly moving forward, foundations and corporations. We're seeing a little bit more movement on the part of some of them to look at the issue of including disability in human rights agendas and others, which is very important. And I believe that the passage of the convention and the ultimate signing and ratifications that are going to go on around the world are helping to stimulate some of the human rights entities to look at this more significantly. But I would say it is, at best, a drop in the bucket. And hopefully it will become a bigger drop over the next few years. But I think that will only occur if we can go beyond convincing the few people who get it to really understand why disability is the same as gender and the same as children and the same of X, Y, and Z. And there again, I think we have to really look at the work that many of the groups in this room are doing in middle-income and developing countries and allow people to actually see how these changes are positively affecting people. I want to talk just a couple of minutes about entities like the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank and the other regional banks and other international development institutions. Most of those institutions are doing very little in the area of disability. I would say that the World Bank is probably the leader on this issue right now, in part because there's so few other players out there. And that it's really critical that the players in this room and throughout the world get a better understanding of how these major development institutions are not only giving money to governments and governments as their primary players, but also ensuring that disabled people within those countries have a real opportunity to be able to participate in the development of various documents that are required by many of these countries. But likewise, there needs to be a voice that these development institutions are hearing from on a regular basis. And that voice needs to be holding these institutions accountable, not once every 3 or 4 years, but they need to be asked now, do you have a policy on disability? What role are you going to be playing in the implementation of the convention? Can we please see what types of specific trainings you are giving for your staff so that if Government X says to a development staff person, we'd like to know more about this convention, or we're interested in looking at how to develop language on education, inclusive education, whatever the particular issue may be, that someone from these institutions is either knowledgeable substantively or knows that the answer should not be, this is not important, don't deal with it, and knows to pick up a phone and speak to somebody like Charlotte at the World Bank who can give them technical assistance. But if you look at the Inter-American Development Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the African Development Bank, on and on and on, there is no infrastructure on disability. And to me, if there is no infrastructure within those institutions, how are they going to meaningfully engage with governments? And even governments that want to engage, who is their partner? Who is really going to be helping? And I think we also need to look at the other donors, like from the EU, Canada, Japan, the United States, Australia, New Zealand. We really do understand this. You have people who are knowledgeable about disability policy in the U.S. government, and they're located in certain places. But if you go to most other places in government in the U.S., they're not knowledgeable about disability policy. Likewise, the people that are doing work in a little unit in USAID who are knowledgeable about disability policy in the U.S., have responsibility for implementing U.S. disability policy, have a great deal of difficulty getting their colleagues in the women's division, for example, in USAID to really adopt and understand how this issue needs to be integrated. So my feeling is we need to have some real specialists in the United States that really are focusing on disability policy, on inclusive development, that really understand what the Ford Foundation, the World Bank, the other major institutions, what type of people do they look for to hire in their organizations? Are universities, in fact, recruiting disabled individuals to study in those fields? And equally importantly, are those universities working with those individuals to get jobs in these institutions? Thanks. Because the few disabled people that I know who are coming out of schools like American University's International School of Studies have very significant problems getting jobs in the development arena. And so people are discouraged from even going in and studying. And we go and we work in NGOs and DPOs, which is fine. But the reality is we need to be in DPOs, we need to be in NGOs, we also need to be working in the foundations, in the corporations, and in the development institutions. So let me just conclude by saying, I think we need to be looking at capacity building, knowledge sharing. We need to look at groups in the U.S. like USAID, the Global Partnership for Disability and Development, some of the IDC and other organizations that are really focusing on this convention. And we cannot forget, and we really need to critically analyze, what we need to do to ensure that the people on the ground who will be the ones that will be working with the DPOs in countries and working with governments who have the responsibility for the ratification and implementation of these conventions are getting the types of technical assistance that they need so that those who in good faith want to do the right thing can get the kind of support that they need. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker, Sam Worthington, is head of Interaction, which is a consortium of international development organizations based in the United States. Interaction has been extremely open to examining how it is that development groups in the United States need to be more inclusive of people with disabilities and develop programs to ensure that they reach out to and are appropriate for people with disabilities. So having him here today is a very, very important sign of the responsiveness of the mainstream international development organizations to the development of the UN Disability Convention.
Well, thank you very much for the chance to talk with you this afternoon. Interaction represents about 165 of the major international humanitarian organizations in this country. We receive about $5 billion from the American public and about $3 billion from the U.S. government through grants and partnerships. When you think of what our organizations do, a prime example in the news right now would be Darfur. It's less what you're seeing in terms of end the genocide, but it's actually the feeding and clothing of about 2 million people on the ground. On a weekly basis, we're dealing with staff being killed, raped, and attacked. So these are organizations that are very much working with those billion people on Earth that live and work on the less than a dollar a day in the poorest parts of the planet. Our community over the years has been increasingly shaped by what I call rights-based approaches, the recognition that this is not out there simply to meet the needs of individuals, but individuals have the right not to starve to death. They have the right not to be beaten. A woman has a right to speak out. A child has a right to have love in a family, and a person who's disabled has a right to participate in his or her society as an active participant. And that changing and recognition that we are partnering with other organizations, institutions in a rights-based structure has placed some tensions and strains on our community, because our rhetoric and our ability to deliver on that rhetoric is to some extent out of sync. About almost 10 years ago, we adopted in our standards, one of the things to become a member of Interaction, you have to meet certain standards as an institution. These go for issues of good governance, how you spend your resources, how you advertise. They then started down the path of what are they on issues of gender, and we passed a number of disability standards in terms of consistent with your mission, what are you doing within your own organization with issues of disability, and as you deliver programs and services, are you do you have a conscious attempt from the outset and design of program through its implementation evaluation to look at integration of issues of disability in your programs? And the reality as these standards passed is that we don't meet them because of the complexity of the world we operate in, but also because I think it was a challenge for the community to look in at itself at our own shortcomings. And one of our members, which Eric is one and there are others, but Mobility International, challenged our community to do a poll looking at how well we were doing. And we ended up with about 104 organizations responding. Again, some of these organizations are very large and others are very small. So when I say 165, they're some of them are very much small church-based groups. Some are large institutions like CARE or World Vision or Oxfam and so forth. And what we found is about a third of the organizations were in some way or shape dealing with programs dealing with disability. That there was a clear underrepresentation within their structures in terms of dealing with disability issues. But the biggest tension was one of, well, what do you do in a Darfur situation? What do you do when you're working in Uganda? What are the models out there that can be used for an organization whose intent is good, but is having difficulty following through on that intent? And this is where a project was launched by Mobility International, and they did some interesting work with a number of organizations to take the practical steps of where can change happen in organizations that are large service delivery organizations who are founded on a mission, who have adopted a profound interest in rights of individuals, and in this global context, and I can't understress the value of this convention, in a global context where the ability to hold a government to account is increased because of these slew of UN conventions that have happened out there. And our ability as institutions that work in service delivery over, again, the last 20 years has shifted oftentimes from let's deliver a service to let's partner with a local civil society actor in the delivery of that service. And this is where it comes to, well, who are you partnering with and how are you making a difference in that partnering? What Mobility International did in this project, and it was a look at those members of Interaction who had raised their hand and said, we've signed up to these standards. We want to do more in addressing them. Help us in the practical implementation of these standards within our own programs. They started off with face-to-face training within on a human rights framework and the principles, human rights principles in the organizations on issues of inclusion and the relevance of inclusion to that organization's mission. For example, I'm relatively new at Interaction. I came from an organization, Plan USA. Our focus was on children, the poorest of the world's children. We worked in 62 countries, 11 million children. It became very apparent that close to 15% of all children around the world were, in essence, disabled. If we weren't touching that level of population in a poor community. We were, in essence, overlooking a population that we must be taking care of and supporting in the sense, and taking care of in the sense of supporting a community to support itself. Another example would be looking at this inclusion in a sense of how do you adapt your programs. I noticed just a side comment on your bit on orphanages there. I think it's very widespread knowledge within our community that the institutionalization of individuals is not an approach to take. And we've wrestled with this significantly in the AIDS orphan crisis in Africa, where you, in essence, have 11 million children who've been orphaned. In the organization I worked with, we, in essence, started a program which eventually touched about 883,000 children to help children stay within their families. And this, again, the stigma of AIDS and the stigma of being a child who's orphaned by AIDS. But what we find is it's much easier oftentimes to sell to the American public, oh, take care of these children, put them in an institution, and you know, give to your local church or temple or whomever to do this. So that message, and we still see it up on Capitol Hill, and we found that we've had to argue against that. But going back to this issue of training, this issue, the need for technical assurance, referrals, the need for partners in country. In every society, there's active civil society, almost. And those actual civil societies, if they are well developed, will include civil society actors who are coming out of the disability community. And oftentimes, the NGO community is working parallel to and not directly working with. What came out of this sort of technical assistance and support from Mobility International was a number of common strategies that we found worked within Interaction members. One, there had to be a commitment from the CEO. This could not be just simply signing on to something, that the leadership of the organization had to say this was a clear commitment. That there had to be a designated key staff within the organization responsible for disabilities. So in the case of Interaction, we've had an area both focusing on disabilities and issues of gender as a key focus for training. It cannot be something that's simply left aside. That there have to be annual targets for inclusion in the programs of the NGOs involved. That there needs to be a baseline assessment of the data and to disaggregate the data in terms of not only as who's being served. This has been an argument being made for many years by the gender community, the need to disaggregate gender data. The same thing is true with data regarding the broader disability community. That the images of people with disability, and especially women and girls, need to be seen as integral parts of programs, as routine parts. That we need to seek out disabled people's organizations for their technical assistance. And that there is, in essence, a reasonable cost allocated for disability-related communications accommodations as it unfolds. This became very much a reality in the tsunami for many of our institutions as we unfolded in reconstructing different parts of, say, Aceh in this case. The push, again, from the donor community was deliver, build, make things happen. It's very different if you then sit down and talk with individuals within a community. What should your community center look like? What are your how are your houses designed? Who is having a say over the nature of your schools and everything from the height of the windows to access to the schools? All these things tend to slow down development work, and oftentimes our communities has to push back and say, well, wait a second, don't judge us simply on the speed of how fast we delivered a service. Look at how it's being done. And this issue of local capacity, of building local capacity of local institutions is crucial. And that this area of ongoing communications about why you can and should make a difference in the lives of those who are most disadvantaged is crucial to both your identity as an institution and how you deliver your projects. It's this barrier, I think, that we confront from this rhetoric of we know we need to meet both this convention and the standards we have for our institution. And the individuals on the ground in a Darfur or in a tsunami region or simply in Central Africa who are saying, how does it apply to me? How can I make a difference? And this is where we are trying to provide training to our members to make that difference. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I just wanted to announce Sam had extended the invitation to this conference to members of Interaction. And at their annual meeting, he also invited us to get together a disability affinity group. So I know, Judy, you're going to be at the meeting. Susie Siegel from MyUSA mentioned she's going to be there. So anybody who is otherwise a member of Interaction will be at there. We'd strongly encourage you to join a discussion group about disability and inclusive development. Our third speaker is John Kemp, who is also one of the great leaders of the disability rights movement in the United States. I got to know him when he was president of USID, the U.S. International Council on Disability, and we worked together to buttonhole members of Congress to try to get legislation through, which we succeeded in, requiring U.S. foreign assistance programs to be accessible to people with disabilities. And so just admired your persuasive qualities with members of Congress, and hope to learn that skill someday myself. He is now on the State Department Advisory Board on Disability, and has some unique experience from the inside. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. I don't think I can live up to that, and I'm honored to be, anytime I can be on a program with Judy Human, I just have to say thank you, Judy, for your great leadership over the years and all you've meant to all of us. And love you very much. And Eric and Lori, thank you very much for putting this together with Professor Dinnerstein and Arlene and lots of leaders in this room. It's really a privilege to be a part of this and to see some really good friends, Jerry and Tom Gilhool in the back and John Lancaster and lots of folks. I'm going to speak from personal orientation as well as from the State Department's Advisory Committee. Why did the State Department create an advisory committee on people with disabilities? And Stephanie Ortaleva, who serves our committee and is sitting in the middle section here about the second last row, and I visited very briefly, and I blame her for nothing. I will take these on as my personal comments and observations. Kathy Martinez has reentered the room, she's also one of the six members of the advisory committee. So I think Kathy and I would probably agree on most of what I'm about to say, and Stephanie has no blame on this at all. The advisory committee was created out of a compromise when Senator Harkin grilled then Secretary Powell about what he was doing about disability issues and foreign aid, and what about this 504 stuff, and what's the State Department's response, and what are you doing about this? And caught totally off guard, they went back, and then with a little bit of nudging from the Senator Harkin's office and staff, they came up with this idea that they would create a six-person advisory committee that would get together periodically, and I use that term loosely, and I think I'm going to do air quotes, okay? I can do air quotes very well. So we get together periodically to discuss huge issues about foreign aid and the UN Convention and a variety of other issues. We've been blessed to have Stephanie there. She is told that she gets to spend approximately one-fourth of her whole time on the issue of supporting our committee. And that's about enough to make sure that the folks get an agenda, get travel, know where they're going. Our next meeting, by the way, will be May 2nd. But it's not enough, and it's completely under-resourced, and it's really a token gesture to the disability community at the highest levels. We did get a photo op and a slight chance outside of the Secretary Rice's office to meet with her one time. We were all standing or sitting in our scooters or wheelchairs. And it was a photo op, a brief set of remarks by her, and we had a chance, a moment, to say something really smart on this broad issue. So it's been very disappointing, to say the least. When we decide that we want to write a report or do something in this area, it falls on us volunteers to do this. We are volunteers. We get our travel paid, but we don't get paid any hourly or daily rate to be able to do this. This is a huge issue for which they need a lot of help, and they've
I think they put us in a class that says that, you know, like many others in the past have said, we just don't really value you as professionals providing input into this area. We'll create an advisory committee. I've been a part of many advisory committees, and I have been paid for my advice, as we should be as people with disabilities. But we take advantage of the opportunity, don't we, Kathy, to speak our minds and to and really to kind of hopefully help Stephanie be able to take the message inward to the State Department that this is a huge set of issues that has unfolded here. We are as disappointed as anybody about the failure of the United States to really step up on the UN Convention. Regardless of how rational it seems to other people, it's been a major disappointment. We do look at issues of foreign aid and how we use the monies that the United States gives to the world's, the countries of the world, and how they can use that money and where it can go. We even had to worry and fret about whether our own embassies around the world were even accessible and should be built accessibly and rebuilt accessibly. But we should be using the power of the federal dollars to really put in some values-based standards about how this money can be spent and for what purposes, and never to allow what Eric pointed out to us about the rebuilding of orphanages that are really exclusionary and not inclusive whatsoever. So we have an opportunity, and we'll keep trying, Stephanie, and I know that Kathy and the other members of our committee will try to represent in the broadest way possible what is going on and how we all feel about inclusion. The office that and the department that Kathy's in, or the bureau, that Stephanie's in, is the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, if I'm saying this right. And then in that, they study issues such as corporate social responsibility. This is in the State Department, along with labor issues. Now, we are going to open that up a little bit and decide what we can talk about in there, but we would think that if there is some social responsibility in the disability area, it would be about reaching out to the margins of all of society and making sure that everyone is included and properly included in all that's going on. My second set of comments have to do with disability leadership and disability culture. To me, what is going on right now is really a challenge to us in the United States and to the disability community at large, that we step up to the leadership challenge that has been given to us, or the opportunity that has been given to us. There were some people that thought when we got Title V of the Rehab Act, I'm looking at Tom Gilhool back there because, you know, he might have been the first author of it, or even the ADA, that we got our rights before our community really had come together. There was a lot of talk about that. And today we even have this, I think, you're going to hear it boomerang back around on us, that this international movement with a treaty and a convention on the rights really kind of was given to us, and we gained it, but our whole community hadn't really come together around all the issues. You're going to hear it. This is what was said for a while in our world about 504. And what we did was hopefully grow up fast. We certainly didn't have the systems in place. Look at the lawsuits that happened under 504, and how many did we lose before we finally got it turned around and started educating the judges and the justices as they went through. And we went literally to the college of the colleges where the judges go to after they get their appointments and really start talking about the philosophy of disability rights in these colleges. But it's taken us a long time to feel worthy of having this opportunity. So disability leadership to me is challenged once again, and it's challenged on an international level, and maybe more so in the United States. I think there are countries that have far exceeded the U.S. disability rights movement. Far exceeded it. They've gained much more. It is not about can we have, should we have. Other countries are there, and their citizenship don't question that people with disabilities have every right to fully participate. So we've got a lot to learn around the world from a lot of great leaders here in the United States. And maybe that's one way that we can talk with the funders as to how to build capacity in the United States about learning what we should know about what's going on around the world. There aren't enough Eric Rosenthal's to travel all over the world and bring back the good information. Culturally, there's a phenomenon called disability culture, or having a culture of disability, and I think it's one that most of us buy into. We share our pride. We share in a pride of disability, in an honor of being a person with a disability. We don't run from our identity as people with disabilities. We have history and art that represents our movement and our us as individuals with varying differences. But we still have a phenomenon here which says that only 47% of people with disabilities accept the identity of disability altogether. And I know disability visits us at any and every stage of life. And some of us, again and again, as I get older, I'm feeling like I should have brought my glasses with me. But there is this phenomenon of disability culture and talking about pride that is just now starting to go out. And I think the transmission of our culture will be expedited by having a treaty and a reason for people to get together and an understanding and appreciation of what it is to live life with a disability. In terms of reporting, I appreciated the 1 o'clock speaker talking about the shame that governments really, that advocates use to shame governments into moving in a certain direction. To me, that is a very effective tool, but it's certainly not enough. It seems to be a slow process and a kind of a, I catch you, I embarrass you, you move a little bit, you appease us a little bit, then we catch you again, and then we play this little cat and mouse game through this process. What we desperately need is some leadership, and we need it from government, and we need it from corporations, and from unions. We need people to step up and take the lead and present an understanding rationale for why inclusion is an appropriate method. Reporting is still going to be required. I work with some very large international corporations, IBM and Hewlett-Packard and other companies like this. And what they're working on, and they feel very proud of this, they really want the disability community to speak up and ask the banks and the governments to deliver to them accessible information and electronic technologies, to give them the ability to participate fully. They're selling product out there, but they've already developed the product in this world that can be used by many, many people. And they're asking the citizens and the customers of the world, don't be accepting second-class status. Speak up about it. Tell your governments that if you're moving to e-government systems, and we think we are, that all people, including people with disabilities, have a right and an opportunity to participate. And governments will pay for it because the product already exists. And we do have this very uneven set of standards, and many of them are voluntary, the ADAG standards in the U.S., and then we have these WCAG standards and the whole area even around beyond the technology world. But I see it as countries having very uneven floors of civil rights. We're not even sure if we have a floor of civil rights in the information age. We don't even know if websites have to be accessible under the Americans with Disabilities Act in the United States. In Estonia, it's a constitutional right to have access to the internet. And we're still screwing around 17 years after ADA trying to figure out if it's a civil right to have access to the internet. Have we been outdone or what? So here we have these uneven floors of civil rights trying to bridge accessibly around the world, creating interoperability and certainly the 33 or 34 sections or articles in the UN Convention mention, at least 9 of them mention E and IT, electronic and information technologies, where at least it's thought about there. If we're going to be able to communicate and be global entrepreneurs with disabilities and communicate with our fellow citizens all around the world, we have to have that. It goes to all other aspects of life. So do we have this interoperability, this ability to communicate? No, and we're far away from it. But we have an opportunity in international law, I think, to start creating these kinds of conversations. Then we have the international DPOs and the NGOs. And I really like separating and talking about DPOs and NGOs separately. I think it's too easy at times, and I sure appreciate, Sam, your comments very much, and I'm really glad you're running the organization, that we tend to think that the NGOs of this world are going to answer all of our problems and do that. There are just as many bureaucracies in NGOs as there are in governments. And unless they're held accountable, such as with the standards that Sam just talked about, they will gladly slide on the disability stuff, gladly. Cost some money, don't know where they're going to get it, got other demands, they got board members breathing down their necks and other funders, and they're gladly skip it if they can skip disability. So to have standards to belong to your organization that require the attention of disability is critical. But what's really essential is that the DPOs, the Disabled People's Organizations, which we don't delineate here very well in the United States, really have to be speaking for people with disabilities. We have to acknowledge that we have the inherent capacity and the ability to speak on behalf of people with disabilities. And it's distinguishing between NPOs and DPOs and NGOs. Last, I just want to mention that one of the dreams of AAPD, the American Association of People with Disabilities, and Ann Summers is here, and I'm really glad you're here, Ann, representing Andy and AAPD, is that AAPD will incubate a elected officials with disabilities organization. It will hopefully create a place where elected officials in the United States can join, can come together, talk about their common issues, and then be spun off into its own, much like women's movements and African American and other minority group members have their own elected officials organizations. None exist right now in the disability world. I see this in the United States and I see this worldwide. And when we start to reach this level of political power and really start talking about it, I think we will have accomplished something and we will have informed the world about how international development policy can and should really operate. Thank you.
Before we go into question and answers, there is a representative of USAID here, Ann Hayes, and they have been responding to the legislation recently to make their programs more accessible. And Ann, do you want to come up to the front and maybe take a few minutes and describe some of the ways that AID has responded to this legislation? Why don't you actually take the podium for a few minutes?
Again, my name is Ann Hayes, and I am a gender and disability specialist working on investing with women in development fellowship. I was in particularly brought on to help implement the USAID policies on disability. Right now, USAID is trying to work on a twin-track approach, trying to integrate all of our programs for people with disabilities, as well as recognizing that separate programs need to exist. For separate programs, through Senator Harkin and some of the great work by a lot of people in this room, there is a separate fund for disabilities. It was established in 2005. This fund has primarily been given to DPOs. In last summer, there was a request for applications that went through missions to work on political partnership or political party building, advocacy, and the majority of the funds went to DPOs within the countries. Russia, Burkina Faso, there's 11 countries that received those fundings. There's also, we're working with MIUSA, that's working with some of the DPOs in Guatemala, Indonesia, a couple other countries, to better integrate USAID staff members to better understand how to integrate people with disabilities, as well as working with DPOs to build their capacity. There's also a request for proposals that will be coming out soon, particularly dedicated to U.S. disability groups. And that should be out hopefully within a couple of weeks. So keep everyone look out for U.S. Fed grants and see when that comes out. There are, towards the integration portion, which is I'm working on a little bit more, there's right now two different distinct disability policies. One is that all new infrastructure should be built accessible. This is particularly something that happened in Afghanistan, in Iraq, where there's most of our construction's being redone. We had some places, which there was an interesting op-ed in the Washington Post about a year and a half ago, where actually there was some resistance to making schools accessible because people didn't really understand. So that's really what I'm trying to do, is to build awareness. Most of the people that I've encountered in USAID are very open to integrating people with disabilities, but aren't really sure of what barriers they might be developing that exclude people with disabilities. The other policy directive is that all requests for applications, request proposals, essentially all contracting mechanisms to get money out, should be inclusive of people with disabilities. Unfortunately, the spirit of the award isn't necessarily being lived out the way that we wanted. What's happening is that it's often put sort of in the back in clausal language that we will integrate people with disabilities, but the actual practice isn't being done. So again, one of the things I'm trying to do is really build awareness of what does that mean? How do you include people with disabilities? How do you reward organizations that show how they'll include people with disabilities? So that when there's an HIV/AIDS program and somewhere in Africa, that they're looking to outreach to disabled persons organizations so that they're included. There's also many different programs within USAID. They're doing separate work on disability, regardless, not using the disability funds, but just doing different programs. For example, India is doing a wonderful program on inclusive education, where they found that no one wanted to include the schools, so they took all the specialized schools and integrated those first and showed how successful it was to have an integrated school system. And then from that are now moving to all the regular state programs. There's also an example in Belarus where they realized that children with disabilities are more prone to be abandoned. So they developed a daycare system where mothers could drop off their children for the day who had a disability being taken care of and then pick them back up at night, because they went and talked to people and said, why are you abandoning your children? It's because they had to work full time. And they were afraid that if they didn't take care of their child, all their other children would be in a disadvantage as well. So the answer was not an institution, but doing some awareness raising in the very beginning and doing a daycare system until the regular schools can take up. There was also, since Dr. Giannini is in the room, the Ninth Congress, the Health and Human Services Ninth Congress on Disability for Children with Disabilities, where USAID sent 24 countries or children with disabilities advocates to participate in that wonderful conference. So these are just a few things that USAID is doing. We've had some successes. We've had some challenges. One of the most interesting programs that I've seen is that in Uganda, there was a lot of work with the mission on the importance of inclusion. And when they were doing their strategic planning for 5 years, they went on a retreat and brought together representatives from disabled persons organizations and said, this is our plans. This is what we plan to do. How do we include disabilities into all of these programs? And so they looked at the plans and they identified 25 areas of where people with disabilities should be included. Of those 25 areas, only 5 required additional funding. The rest just meant some modifications and adaptations to make sure that the barriers didn't exist, have your training in an accessible facility, giving out materials in hard copy as well as electronic form, using larger fonts. So these are just some of the things that USAID is trying to do. It's a challenge, little successes. My boss is Lloyd Feinberg, who's the disability coordinator for USAID. He also works on the Fund for Displaced Children and Orphans, Victims of Torture, and Leahy's War Victim Fund. Leahy's War Victim Fund is another vehicle of which people with disabilities have been addressed. It started out primarily looking at people who had a disability as a result of the war, doing rehabilitation needs, and then it became very clear that needs to be moved to more social economic. And then it also became very clear that you can't just work with people who are injured because of the war, but you need to look at all people with disabilities. So the Leahy's War Victim Fund has definitely moved to a much broader sense, primarily still working in areas of post-conflict, but working in social, economic, and with all people with disabilities. So just a few words.
Okay, we've got about 10 minutes for questions and answers. Tina?
First, I really want to thank all the members of this panel, because I think we're really starting to move towards what we need to do in terms of strategy. So it was a very good organization of the conference, the way it's progressing. I wanted to say to make a few comments or questions for Judy in particular. First, I think your idea that we should have some materials to be disseminating to the disability community to get people involved is a very good idea. I would be interested in working on that with people, and we can talk about that more. And we also need, in addition to materials, we need strategies to look at the gaps, who should be here and isn't here, and to see how we're going to reach out to the various communities of disabled people and make sure everybody is here. I wanted to ask two things. One, you mentioned something about accessing funding for DPOs in the U.S. to implement the convention. If you were talking about for domestic implementation, I'd be very interested in knowing about that. Or you're talking about more DPOs doing work internationally. Okay.
No. I think the point that Anne was making relates to both. I think that Anne's point is that there's going to be an RFP which is going to come out, not specifically on the convention, I presume, but I presume it's somewhat open or not. Is it specific?
It's not very specific. I'm not sure. I honestly can't address whether or not it can be at the convention without a signing yet. I can look into that. I'm not sure.
But potentially on the issue, maybe it could be looked at from an advocacy perspective. So maybe it could be looked at in relationship to democracy and how disability groups here have done self-help and advocacy and not speak specifically to the convention. But the USAID money, however it comes out, is looking at DPOs in the U.S., right?
Yes. Okay. That's
and the other one that I was talking about was, I don't think there's an answer yet as to whether it's exclusively international or not. It's a new fund being developed.
The other question that I just wanted to ask is I know you're involved with the Global Partnership on Disability and Development, and is the Global Partnership taking the rights-based approach and just and looking at the convention as the standard for how people are going to see the implementation of disability issues in a development context?
I would say the answer to that is yes. Yeah. Maybe because a number of the projects that they're working on are rights-based projects, empowerment projects, training projects, specifically to DPOs. The trainings right now have been focusing on issues like poverty reduction strategy issues, which are relevant in some of the countries, but it's very much a rights-based approach.
Okay, we'll take one last question, if there is any. Yerker?
I know you've discussed a bit about the different intellectual disability groups, but there's an additional one that I think is important to mention, and that's the National Council on Disabilities that also focuses on disabilities that has a little bit of an international perspective as well. I think that's an excellent place for the exchange of ideas and information, so I think it would be pertinent to ask Kathy Martinez to give a little brief discussion about that if she wouldn't mind.
Yeah. Kathy, do you want to say a word or?
That was helpful. Can people hear me?
Yeah.
Right. Thank you. What Yerker's talking about is a committee that the National Council on Disability hosts called International Watch, and the purpose is really to exchange ideas and information. I happen to facilitate that committee. And I think that over the years it's been very helpful to determine the focus. It's an advisory committee for the council, and it really did help determine the focus of our paper on foreign assistance and disability, and it has helped kind of bring folks together. I think it's a good, it's what quarterly conference calls. I think it's a great, good things have happened, but I think we need more than that as well. But I want to thank Yerker for bringing it to everybody's attention.
Our next coffee break is brief because the next workshop is starting at 4:30, probably the most important workshop. So I encourage people please to stay. So relax a little bit, grab some refreshments, and we'll get going at 4:30 sharp. Thank you.